At last, I have it. I've spent years looking for this old wooden chest that contains the letters of Sarah Childress Polk, wife of the 11th President of the United States. A devout Presbyterian, as First Lady, she banned dancing, card games, and hard liquor at presidential functions, and never attended horse races or the theater. But we historians believe she also played a major role in shaping the policies and alliances of the president. This should tell us so much more. Oh, look at this one, to Martin Van Buren. My dearest Martin, I so enjoyed our Sunday afternoon revels. The two families must have had a picnic. Martin Jr. was certainly frisky and came back for seconds. I guess kids were big eaters even back then. And when you, I can't make out this word, perpetrated, fenestrated me, you were like one of those naughty tomcats who enjoy the moonlight on our rooftops. I hope you noticed my meows of pleasure. I'm going to put this one away. Here's a letter to Franklin Pierce. My Randy Frankie, I do not believe I understood the phrase manifest destiny until last night when, with the vigorous and precise movement of your hips, you... I can't believe this. The most virtuous first lady in the history of the Republic was a secret sex monster? These correspondences have the potential to reshape our understanding of an entire era. As a historian, I have one primary responsibility. Dear Daily Mail, you think the stuff you printed about George Clooney was hot? Have I got some letters for you, but only if the price is right. This may take a while, so enjoy our scramble about LeBron James, Warren Harding, and a song about a ticking biological clock. And now, mourning the death of Archie, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, I just found out about that as I went on the air, that supposedly Archie, I mean the comic book Archie, who I think we did our first show, we talked about Archie, and here it's almost our fifth anniversary, and Archie apparently spoiler alert, Archie has died, he's been shot, he took a bullet for somebody, I'm amazed I'm even on the air. I should be lying down in a dark room. All right, so we have a great scramble for you today, and many of the things that were alluded to in the introduction will be touched upon later today. That would include, of course, the letters from Warren G. Harding to one of his mistresses, and also we'll be talking a little bit later about a kind of standoff between the Daily Mail, a scurrilous British tabloid, and George Clooney, and what its actual implications are for kind of global journalism. I mean, we're not going to just climb down in there in the muck with the Daily Mail. We have a higher purpose. We always do. Starting off here is our super guest today is Anna Sale. She's the host and managing editor of Death, Sex, and Money, a biweekly podcast at WNYC. It's available on iTunes at deathsexmoney.org. She's also a frequent fill-in host for the Brian Lehrer Show and the Leonard Lopate Show. We're excited to have her here. She's also, of course, a product of the John Dan Kosky Public Radio Farm System, which has molded superstars all over the country, including Anna. Well, welcome back to your old home, Anna Sale.
Thank you, Colin, and I'm quite sure I would never have been a super guest were it not for John Dan Kosky.
Well, we all owe something to John Dan Kosky, and spelling it all out would take way too much time. So I was thrilled that you wanted to talk about LeBron and, you know, obviously not necessarily his basketball impact, but kind of the way he decided to tell this story of his decision to leave Miami, which he kind of picked out, you know, at a moment it was rising up as an American third coast for flash and entertainment and media attention, and go back whence he came, a boy from Akron, Ohio, heading back to the Cleveland franchise where he started out. So what does this mean to you?
Well, I just love this story because I think a lot about home and where home is for me, and the ways that home and where we feel like we belong can become so infused with really strong emotions, as we saw when LeBron James left Cleveland. I'm from West Virginia, which is a state where a lot of people leave, and the people who stay have this sense of, you know, why are we not good enough for you? And there's this, you know, resentfulness about the people who choose to leave the state. And then the people who leave feel that pull back and then just kind of don't know what to do with it. So I related to this personally, and I just thought the way LeBron James handled it this time, his announcement, of course, not with the flash of a big press conference live on ESPN, but with a personal reflection that he did in conjunction with a Sports Illustrated journalist, but posted it on the website on Friday about why this decision felt right for him, for his family, for him for going back home. And I think he did it quite beautifully. I thought it was really honest and reflective, which is not what you often hear from some of the, you know, most famous stars in the NPA.
I agree. I was intrigued by the sort of old-fashioned storytelling format of the essay. As you say, in 2010, he had this live ESPN special called The Decision, which was all about his decision to sign with the Heat, but it was all revealed there live. It was, to his everlasting credit, I suppose, broadcast from the Boys and Girls Club of Greenwich, Connecticut. It raised $2.5 million for that charity and an additional $3.5 million from advertising revenue that was donated to other charities. Notwithstanding that, though, people really did detect in that a level of self-involvement and grandiosity that seemed to also fit with this choice of moving from a fairly drab Rust Belt city to the heat and flash of Miami.
And not just grandiosity, but insensitivity. Like, how could this guy, this boy who'd grown up in Akron, gone on to be one of the proudest products of Northeast Ohio, how could he look to the people that he played for in Cleveland and do this with such flash? I mean, it's particularly heartbreaking, I think, when you're from a part of the country that struggled. And in West Virginia, I know we love to just, you know, list all of the people who've been successful who have ties to the state, because it's in some ways a way to answer that feeling of inadequacy or inferiority, or why are we a place that doesn't have the respect that the rest of the country gets. And that's why I think it was so insulting and sad for Cleveland fans and for people in Akron when he left 4 years ago. But the way he flipped it, the way LeBron flipped it by characterizing his move to Miami as something he needed to do, and if he had to do it again, he would do the same thing. And he compared it to college, to 4 years away when he grew up, when he accomplished some things that he needed to accomplish, but now he's ready to come home. I mean, that works for people. That works for people in Northeast Ohio, I imagine, because they get that. You need to go away. You need to see what you can see. But that idea of home is important, and now's the time when I'm prioritizing that. It's just a great story.
Yeah. After I read your comments about that, I went back and reread the essay. And the word that popped into my mind was Bildungsroman, you know, that term for the coming of age novel. And of course, there is a famous
Bildung. That was not the term that flipped into my head, I have to be honest, Colin.
Well, there is a famous Bildungsroman by Philip Roth called Goodbye Columbus, which is just, you know, maybe 150, 200 miles away from Akron. But you know, I do feel we're all trying to tell our life story, right? To a certain degree, we're trying to live a life that's worthy of telling, and then to be able to tell that story. And I think he struggled a little bit to find the right narrative for himself. I mean, the decision to go to Miami didn't go over all that well. And in his time in Miami, it seemed so much about him, and he was constantly judged by whether he prevailed or failed. And often when he would fail, it would be against a group of people who were more of a team. And somehow or other, the drama of LeBron was always the drama of LeBron. You know, I mean, was he going to be good enough to pull his team over the finish line in any given season? And he often was. But it goes back to something Mark Oppenheimer said off-air last week on a show. He said, you know, his brother has this theory that everybody needs a nemesis. You know, everybody needs somebody who's just not somebody they hate, but somebody who's just a little bit better than they are, or almost as good as they are, somebody to make you push yourself a little bit or compare yourself against so that you vault over that next hurdle. And for LeBron, you know, it hasn't been a Magic and Bird kind of thing. It's like his nemesis kind of is himself and people's expectations of him, or other teams that play more as a team than he does, or than he's alleged to do. And I think he is looking for a way to tell his story. And as you say, he's found this very nice way of telling a story about caring about another place and maybe championing that place and having that be his story.
Yeah, I mean, and he did not, I mean, he really went for it. He's in Northeast Ohio. Nothing is given. Everything is earned. You work for what you have. I'm ready to accept the challenge. I'm coming home. I mean, he just, you know, went right for those heartstrings in Northeast Ohio. And then he also made the point that he knows he's going to have to be patient. He mentioned that it's a younger team and it's a new coach. And so I think that is exactly what you were saying, him saying, I'm ready to be a leader on a team and not just a star. star player that everyone looks to win the games. I want to be a mentor. I want to cultivate this team, nurture it, and I'm ready to put the work in, which is not the way we thought of LeBron James prior to this announcement last week.
Once I realized what your take was on all this, Anna Sale, I felt as though I couldn't have this conversation with you without mentioning Thomas Wolfe, who wrote You Can't Go Home Again and Look Homeward Angel in You Can't Go Home Again. He writes, but why had he always felt so strongly the magnetic pull of home? Why had he thought so much about it and remembered it with such blazing accuracy if it did not matter, and if this little town and the immortal hills around it was not the only home he had on earth? He did not know. All that he knew was that the years flow by like water, and that one day men come home again. So, and women, I would imagine, too. Do you ever fantasize about, I mean, obviously you are headed for a public radio superstardom and podcasting mega success. Do you ever fantasize about coming back to Wheeling, West Virginia? Or I don't know where actually in West Virginia you're from. I just pulled that out of nowhere. Do you ever fantasize about going back to West Virginia and doing something for the place that still, I mean, it's enough home for you that you earlier in the conversation used we to refer to West Virginia. Do you ever think, well, maybe I'll go home someday?
Well, I'm from Charleston, and absolutely. I mean, this is like something West Virginia, you just can't quite get it out of your rearview mirror. And you think about not only like what would it be like if I went home, but what is my obligation to this state, and what are ways that I can continue to show that I love my home and the place that I'm from, you know, because it's a place that could use some help, you know. And so right now in my life, that means that I focus my charitable giving in West Virginia because I feel like New York dollars go further in West Virginia than they do in New York City. But then the question becomes, and I think this is probably something LeBron James may have thought about. It's like when you leave home and when you do things elsewhere and when you create a community in your new home, it's like what would it be like? Can I go home again? You know, all my sisters have fled to the winds, and the place that I grew up in doesn't exist anymore. And my parents are there. But I think that pull of home is still there, even though, you know, it's a question of how much of it is it actually this place and how much of it is nostalgia that gets triggered when you get older.
I think you're asking exactly the right question. I don't know what the answer is, but you're asking the right question. All right, we're going to transition from there. Another great topic Anna Sale has picked is a new Jenny Lewis song, Just One of the Guys. Wolfie, why don't we just hear a bit of Just One of the Guys, and then we'll talk about it.
No matter how I try to be just one of
All right, we just played a clip from the middle of the song where Jenny sort of tips her hand in case you didn't understand what this song was about. Let's make sure that you absolutely do. So, Anna Sale, tell us why you picked this Jenny Lewis song to talk about.
Well, I love that she wrote this song because I think of Jenny Lewis as this super hip, you know, indie rocker, the coolest girl in the room whenever she walks in. She was in the band Rilo Kiley with a bunch of dudes. Like, she's just that, like, really cool rock star who just seems, like, completely untouchable by, you know, the concerns of mere, you know, civilians. But this song, it just perfectly encapsulates the way it encapsulates baby fever for women in their 30s in a way that you can't quite articulate what it is that you're feeling when you feel that biological clock ticking. You know it's there. You don't know quite what to do with it. But it's that, you know, she says she looks in the mirror. She's 38 years old and sees a lady without a baby. And not that that means she needs to have children, but it – I just like that it's a cool celebration of this experience that women go through, women who you know, make it to that age and haven't had kids, and that question of, is this okay that I just feel this pull, or is this a pull I need to respond to? And I like that it's a cool song that gets into that.
The and I think I like the way she sets it up, too, the desire to be one of the guys. In other words, in her milieu, that means being one of all these other rock stars, but male rock stars don't really hear any particular, at least they don't hear that clock ticking. They may hear other clocks ticking, but so they're not really sort of thinking, wow, do I need to stop doing this and focus on something else? I mean, presumably anyway, they, at least biologically, they don't need to do that. I mean, as a matter of growth and life story, they may decide it's time to do some child rearing. But it really, really just is a different thing, right? She can't just relax and lay back and enjoy the ride of being a rock star without constantly asking herself that question.
Yeah, and I think that she's, I like that she's just directly addressing it, because it kind of, as a woman in my 30s, when you talk about that pull and trying to figure out what to do with it, it can seem like you're just such a cliche. Like, it's not interesting to talk about biological clocks if you're a woman. It's not hip. It's not cool. And that Ginny Lewis is just saying, like, here's what makes me different from all these dudes on the tour bus with me. Like, I feel this thing, and this is what sets me apart, and I try to explain it to them, but all these guys, I can't be just one of the guys. It's something that's a little bit different that I'm working through.
Well, you know, Anisale, I've been known to force a through line where none exists, but I think we could, without a lot of nudging, relate this to LeBron and his Bildungsroman, because
okay.
Ginny Lewis also wrote fairly recently with a dude from Vampire Weekend this song that aired on Girls last season, and it's at least nominally about taking too many drugs and winding up in the hospital. But even the title connects to the new song because it's so much a whole. Both songs are kind of a question about, when am I me? You know, when am I the person I really ought to be? So this song is called Completely Not Me. We'll just hear a little bit of it.
I could have died that night, way back in June. Saw my soul hang heavy above the room. Slack-jawed, I confess, bit by my hubris. I was spooked out, obsessed by the moon. I was completely.
All right, Completely Not Me. You know, listening to that and then listening to the song that you guided us to, Anisale, I was thinking, this is one of the things that our favorite artists do, particularly our favorite musical artists. If we're going to live with them across the decades, they're going to, you know, kick all these signposts for us. And, mm-hmm. I mean, for people of my generation, maybe Paul Simon is a guy who, you know, in decade after decade has kind of raised a whole bunch of interesting life questions. And to me, these two songs together are kind of interesting. One of them is about, it appears to be anyway, about this night of total excess where you wind up in a hospital and things aren't so good and you were completely not you, but you're coming clean. And then, you know, a year or so later, you're also thinking, wow, maybe I need to stop doing this stuff and have a kid, you know.
Yeah, and I also think that that excerpt you just played, it started, I could have died that night, in the ways that are, you know, when we have those flashes of our mortality and flashes of aging and that thing, all of this doesn't last forever, it causes these big questions to come up.
And that is the perfect segue to our third topic. The third topic you picked out involves the broadcaster Diane Rehm, who does a wonderful public radio show, which we don't happen to air here on this station, but it is terrific, and occasionally I make a special effort to listen to it. She does a very special kind of interview. But what is maybe a little less well-known about her is her long marriage. I think she was married for 54 years to one man. I'll let you kind of pick up the story from there.
Well, this was one of those stories that I saw it flicker past on Twitter and then clicked on it and knew nothing about what she was going through personally while she's been hosting her show. But it's an NBC News article that came out last week where she gave an interview and talked about the death of her husband earlier this summer. Her husband, John Rehm, they were married 54 years, and he was struggling with Parkinson's disease and had been living in assisted living for a couple of years, but they had made the decision that when he became so frail, he wanted to end his life and he wanted to do it. he wanted to make that decision. And the story that she tells is one of feeling frustrated by the constraints of law where they lived in Maryland and the ability of doctors to help him realize that wish. And basically what ended up happening is that her husband's doctor said he could not legally, morally, or ethically help him end his life. So he ended up dying by dehydration, and it took 9 days, she says. And the quote that just immediately grabbed me is she said that at the end of his life, she said, John said he felt betrayed. I felt like when the time came, you would be able to help me, was the feeling that she had with her husband at the end of his life. And it's just a sad story and a window into how little control we have at the end of our lives, how we try to, you know, depending on what state we live in, whether assisted suicide is possible, whether doctors are able to help you make that decision, whether that's a decision that you feel comfortable with, if you have a degenerative disease, if you want to be in charge, if you want to let nature take its course. But her story really, it just hit me, and just the sadness of not only that it took so many days of suffering from dehydration for her husband to finally die, but also she was going back and forth and visiting him, and she just missed being by his side when he finally passed. She said she's about 20 minutes late when it finally happened. So it just made me think a lot about the decisions we make about end of life together with our loved ones. And even when we have those hard conversations, that we can still be hamstrung by what the laws are where we live.
I agree. For me, it is it's a complex thing, and I've had to face it a couple of times in my life with each of my parents and in different ways. And one of the things that I think the more time you spend with it and the more time you spend with life experience with it, at least for me, the more agnostic about it I've gotten. I think it's for me, it's a very moving target. For example, my father, for all of his life, was very sort of robustly all about no heroic measures ever being taken. He actually had written out this whole living will that was a very funny, because he was a very funny guy, it was a very funny living will, but it was all about what he didn't want done for him. And then, you know, as he was getting closer and closer to death, he at one point even wondered if he could get a liver transplant. He was in his 80s and had cirrhosis, and he was the least likely person to get a liver transplant in the world. But that wasn't the father that I'd known for 70 or 75 preceding years. Well, I didn't know him for all those years, but for my entire life anyway. I was in my 40s at that point. I just had never heard that guy before. But as he was facing death, he looked at it a little bit differently. My mother, I had the opposite of experience, and one that I do second guess myself about. She had always been much more inclined toward heroic measures for her. But in the last stages of her life, she had Alzheimer's disease and a broken neck, and was starting to get these series of infections where every couple of days she'd have to be whisked out of the nursing home to an emergency room where she'd lie in a stretcher in a hallway for 12 hours until somebody could find a bed for her. And the whole thing was just kind of agony. And at one point, I just sat down with a bunch of medical professionals, including the nursing home people and some hospice people. And we really started talking about taking her over towards a more palliative care model, where rather than rush her to the emergency room every time and put her through all this agony, and her neck would hurt when this happened, and, you know, maybe just the next infection, we'll just sort of see what happens. And I'm not really sure that decision did shorten her life, but she did die very quickly and suddenly while we had her in this palliative care model. And I was sort of thinking, wow, if I went back to, you know, her last lucid statement about this kind of thing, she would have been saying, no, tear the world apart to keep me alive. I have no idea whether I did the right thing at all in those situations, but it got very complicated. That's the one thing that I know, that the whole notion of informed consent really started to, you know, it really moved around. It was a real hard thing to put your finger on in those last stages. And so I can understand why medical professionals are saying, really, you want me to be the person who decides, okay, now's the time to give him the lethal dose of whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that about, because the moving target, because it's true. I mean, at a certain point, if you say no heroic measures, well, is an antibiotic a heroic measure if you have an infection? I mean, and that becomes the kind of step-by-step logistical question you have to answer when someone you love is dying, and it's definitely not clear cut. But this story did make me think about a story on Morning Edition from late in June, and it's just kind of the other side of the coin of this. It's an incredible story about a family in upstate New York, Ithaca, New York, and it was done by the reporter Elise Spiegel, and it's called "How a Woman's Plan to Kill Herself Helped Her Family Grieve," and it's the opposite story than what Diane Rehm experienced with her husband. It was an emeritus professor at Cornell who was suffering from Alzheimer's, and she had always told her family when she got to a certain point she was going to end her life, and not everybody in her family felt comfortable with that decision. But the story that Elise Spiegel told on the radio, and it's just a captivating radio story, is about how they made the decision, how this woman, Sandra Byrne, she finally set a date for when she was going to take a drug overdose that she ordered off the internet. And a few days prior to that date, she had a funeral, a memorial service that she got to attend. And her family was there, her husband was there, her friends and family were there, and they got to say goodbye to her before she made that decision. So it's just not that any of this is the better than the other. It's just, as you were saying, it's all of this is moving targets. But I think that these are two really interesting stories about the way it can go when we're trying to figure out how to honor our loved ones' wishes, how we're trying to say goodbye, and how even if we're able to make these decisions personally, intimately with the people we love, there's still systems and laws and medical professionals that we have to engage with, and figuring out how to align all those is no easy task.
Yeah, no, I love the story that you just told, and the idea of her being able to be at that memorial service. We'd have to do so many of these things in moments of desperation. So doing that in such an orderly way and in a way that sort of included her even at that level, that's fabulous. And, you know, I mean, once again, not to force a through line, but really the question that we're asking in these end of life times is, when am I completely not me? You know, because then when I'm not me anymore, it's really time to go. If I'm not going to rebound and be me again, then it is time to go. Well, listen, Anna Sale, you have been a fascinating conversational partner, and we just look forward to watching your ascent to the ranks of superstardom and then all the wonderful things you'll do for West Virginia when that comes. But thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Colin.
All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. You may have read on page one of the New York Times this weekend, George Clooney and the Daily Mail having kind of an interesting conversation. And it's a conversation about a famous person trying to take charge of his own narrative. Let me die. All right, we're back. This is The Scramble, and we're back with a different topic and with a different guest now. We're excited to have Ken Doctor. We talked about titles last week. He is, I believe, America's only accredited doctor of Newsonomics. He's a media analyst and consultant and the author of Newsonomics 12 Trends, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Got. And you can learn more at newsonomics.com. So this week, or actually on Saturday, those of us who get the New York Times in newspaper form, read on page one, about a battle going on between George Clooney and the Daily Mail, and particularly the Mail Online, I think. And the Daily Mail is a British newspaper. It is of the tabloid ilk, and it has been delving into George Clooney's marriage, upcoming marriage to a woman of Lebanese descent, and suggesting in print that the Lebanese mother of his fiancée was having problems with the wedding and that there had been joking in the family about the death of the bride if she defied her mother's wishes, which is all completely fascinating, except apparently none of it's true. And George Clooney's very upset about this and has been writing responses that have been published in USA Today. And we'll talk a little bit about what the nature of those responses are. But Ken Doctor, in terms of the newspaper business and the online news business, this is a certain kind of moment, right? We're sort of looking at a moment where one of the things that George Clooney is talking about is the way news travels to unanticipated audiences, to audiences that exist all over the world.
And once it's out of the bottle, there's no putting it back in. As we know in this case, Mail Online took the story down disagreeing with George Clooney, saying it wasn't completely fabricated, it was just inaccurate, and took the story down. But, of course, both of the original story floating out there, cited on probably thousands of blogs, and then his reply to it very much keeps it alive, and in the Google search engine, it'll be alive forever. And so that is the way of the world today.
And I wonder if, from your point of view, too, one of the shifts here is if 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even, you know, if one lives in England and one knows what the Daily Mail is, and then one makes one's own decision about how much weight to put on what they say. But if you listen to Brits, you know, you know pretty much how much weight the typical educated, thoughtful Brit puts on the reporting of the Daily Mail. I mean, there's a thing, so there's almost a trope, a Daily Mail story. On today's Mail Online, Beyonce and Jay-Z turn to online marriage counseling while on joint tour as cheating rumors continue to circulate. But meanwhile, my favorite, Ken, would you have a $500 butt facial, body conscious holiday makers splashing out on tip top tush treatment that promises to get bottoms beach ready? Well, those are like Daily Mail stories. By the way, I wasn't asking you whether you would have a butt facial. That I consider that your business. But you know what this is. But the question is, does somebody reading it in Lebanon, does somebody reading it anywhere else in the world, have any particular idea what the pedigree and therefore value of a Daily Mail story is? That's kind of what you're asking, right?
Right. I mean, and it's very interesting with this one in particular, in that Mail Online is doing what others are doing, but they love to be able to say they are the most read newspaper site. So anybody we know in this world can publish anything, and it can go to every end of the earth. But in this case, they claim the mantle of the number one visited newspaper site in the world. And so that is confusing people here. And they're saying, well, it's a newspaper. It's a newspaper site. And even if you compare the Daily Mail in print, which is kind of there's nothing quite like it in the U.S., and you're right about how well-educated people take it in Britain, Mail Online is something different. It really isn't the Daily Mail Online. It is a celebrity rag, much more like the National Enquirer, but they found that two-thirds of their audience is outside of Britain, that this stuff travels and this stuff, there's an endless appetite. If you look at that page, that homepage, what they pioneered is called the endless scroll.
Yes.
You cannot find the bottom of that page. There are endless numbers of celebrity stories, and they will roll through forever. Now, the only good part of this is that the Internet is its own self-checking device, but it's an uneven self-checking device. So George Clooney can say what he wants to say in the New York Times, in USA Today, and directly, if he wants, on his own blog or whatever. And that, too, will circulate all the way around the world. So that people in Lebanon, if they're using the Google search engine, and they probably are, will see both. So that's the world we're in. You can publish anything and get it out there, but also the self-correcting mechanism, as uneven and sometimes as unfair as it is, exists right side by side.
And just very quickly, Clooney's point actually is that he feels as though this isn't just a story about Beyonce and Jay-Z getting marriage counseling. This is a story that brings in and kicks a lot of possible tripwires and could put members of his extended family or his fiance's family in harm's way. The other thing that we're seeing here, obviously, is that on the Internet is this huge happy hunting ground for this kind of material. So we've seen the rise in the U.S. of TMZ and Perez Hilton. We've seen, and perhaps significantly, the Mail Online has recruited an executive from BuzzFeed to run this North American operation. What does that say to you?
So it says to me that they see in their numbers, both their traffic numbers and their advertising numbers, great growth. And the great growth is going to be outside of the UK. So they hired John Steinberg, former president of BuzzFeed, to greatly expand and really to focus on advertising. Because if you look at their numbers, it's very interesting. The traffic's exploding, but the advertising is very, very small in the United States, which also tells you that advertisers do not consider it a legitimate medium to reach customers. So they're trying to legitimize themselves with the advertising community by hiring a experienced U.S. media executive. And this is the nature, too, and this is a globalization we're seeing across the board. At the same time, they're over here. New York Times and Wall Street Journal are busily trying to really ramp up their international operations. So we talk about globalism. This is the reality of globalism, is that the boundaries are down for very legitimate news media and for everybody else. And if you want to have the National Enquirer, why only have it at the supermarket checkout lane when you can have it worldwide, essentially as free distribution?
You can read
That's
it
the world we're in.
Right. You can read it on your phone while you're so far back in the checkout line you haven't gotten to the magazine racks. Last year I'd like to just ask you about, obviously, the Murdoch Empire has just been through this tremendous, I mean, the whole thing, their whole operation got called on the carpet, got dragged into court. Some people got convicted, other people got off. But there was, one had a sense maybe that there'd be a chastening effect on British tabloids. The fact that obviously this story isn't about hacking into people's private accounts. On the other hand, it also doesn't suggest that British tabloids have in any significant way been brought to heel. What are your senses of that?
Yeah, I think that's the case. And I think what they did is they ducked, and there were parliamentary hearings and a lot of harumphing by members of parliament. But this is, and you can look at the Clooney case. Angelina Jolie is suing the Daily Mail, and other tabloids have been responsible for similar kinds of things. This becomes a cost of doing business in Britain. You get sued, you settle. Daily Mail has settled numerous suits at this point. You can do that as the cost of business, because the readership for this stuff is still very, very strong, especially in print in Britain, and it is more mainstream. So it's interesting. You look at Murdoch. I think he's 83 or 84 now. He's now trying to consolidate his TV empire. So even he has absorbed this blow. And the Murdoch, the influence of Hackgate, which was pretty odious, is ebbing away very quickly. And I guess, you put put all of it together, the public memory, whether it's about, false accusations about George Clooney's fiancée or real happenings such as Hackgate, all of this stuff kind of ebbs away. And if you have a business model that says, this appetite is really, really strong, we're just going to keep feeding it, you're probably going to succeed, at least with audience. Whether you can succeed with advertising, maybe another question for them. So there's a business issue here, but the public appetite for this kind of celebrity trash, really, is apparently endless.
Well, as somebody with a long-running column in the Hartford Current, I'm keeping my eye on Murdoch right now, too, because apparently...
There's significant concerns in Los Angeles, and we know he wants the LA Times, and the Current could be collateral damage, that he would take the Current to get the LA Times.
Right.
But that's a story for another time.
Buy one, get six free. All right. Ken Doctor, so great to talk to you today. I'm sure we'll have other things to talk about in the future, but thanks for joining the Scramble.
Good talk. Bye.
We'll take a little break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the Warren G. Harding story. But even if you've heard something about the Warren G. Harding letter story, believe me, you haven't heard anybody like the guest we have for you.
Read it in the tabloids. You know my town. I used to be a boy. Ooh, I saw it in the tabloids. Right next to...
Hey, Internet, can you show those poor Argentine players the hamster with the birthday hat eating the little piece of cake? Cheer those guys up. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Lily Tyson and Allison Ehrenreich. Happy birthday to Where We Live producer Lydia Brown. The part of Bill Curry was played by Millard Fillmore. For show pages, articles, and steamy letters from the Faith Middleton Show staff to Zachary Taylor's private chef, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, how comfortable is Germany with celebrations of Germany? And now, back to calling.
Yeah, we sort of saw in the concatenation of Germany's victory in the World Cup and the republication of the long-banned Mein Kampf, a kind of an interesting opportunity to talk about Germany's comfort, former lack thereof, and maybe growing new comfort with triumphalism. So that'll be the conversation tomorrow. We have some really interesting guests for you, but let's focus on today. If I were to make a list of the 10 funniest novels I've ever read in my life, there's absolutely no way I could keep off that list my search for Warren G. Harding by our guest, Robert Plunkett. It is, it's just one of the funniest novels I've ever read in my life. So there. And so when this story broke about the disclosure of these letters from Warren G. Harding to his mistress, or one of his two mistresses, I thought, well, been there, done that, read the book, got the T-shirt. It's also been kind of a small plot line on Boardwalk Empire on HBO. But we got to wondering, what does Robert Plunkett think about this? So he's joining us right now. Novelist Robert Plunkett is joining us. As you read about these letters to Carrie Phillips, who we should say is not really of the two mistresses the one that you had the greatest interest in, did anything new jump out at you apart from the fact that the president referred to his member as Jerry?
Well, he did that with his other girlfriend also. But the thing that really, really impressed me about the letters is that they were so beautifully written. He really had a flow to his written voice. So I was very, very impressed with him as a writer.
Yeah, there is. I mean, even though the letters are frankly erotic and have little poems in them in which paradise is rhymed with thighs, there is, I would agree, there's an eloquence to them. And does that comport with the mental model you had of this man as you were? I mean, the novel that you wrote, we should emphasize, is not set in the time of Warren G. Harding, and it's therefore not directly about Warren G. Harding. It's about an unscrupulous, miserable historian who will do anything to get his hands on a set of letters very much like the ones that we're talking about right now. But you had to sort of think out Harding himself. Is the guy you're reading in these letters pretty much who you knew he was?
He's exactly who he was. And I think it makes you realize that, you know, maybe he wasn't as awful as people think. I'm a little bit flabbergasted that he's always considered such a terrible president. But, you know, this was the early 20s, and presidents really didn't have to do much, particularly Republicans. All they had to do was defer to big business, which he did beautifully.
So one of the things that we know is that the existence of these letters, I mean, it wasn't a secret, and that in 1964 there was a historian named Francis Russell who gained access to some of these letters from Warren Harding to Carrie Fulton Phillips, and the Harding family was able to sue to halt their publication. So the only thing that's really changed now is that the Harding family can't get in the way of this stuff, right? The existence of these letters was a fairly open thing.
Yes, correct. I mean, these were famous letters that you couldn't get a look at until now, which is what makes them so interesting.
But you know, the mistress you were more interested in was Nan Britton. So tell us about Nan, and then we'll come back to Carrie for just a second. Who was Nan?
Well, Nan was the Monica Lewinsky of her day. She was much younger than Carrie. Carrie was a middle-aged housewife who was a social equal of Harding. Nan was, she met Harding when she was 15 years old, developed a tremendous crush on him, and set out to get him. And she did. And they had a very torrid affair, which went on for maybe 5 or so years. And he was very attentive to her, very generous. The problem occurred when she became pregnant and had a daughter. So she ended up with the president's daughter. And in fact, when Harding died and she could not get any more money out of the family or the estate, so she wrote a book called The President's Daughter. And it was one of the first tell-all books where she told her whole story, the seduction, the affair, the illegitimate child, and it was an enormous bestseller back in the late 20s.
Yeah, go ahead.
And unfortunately, her ploy didn't work. She still couldn't get any money out of them. And she kind of gave up and faded into obscurity, even though she lived until 1991.
In my recollection, it's been a long time since I read My Search for Warren G. Harding, but that it was somebody based more or less on her that was holding on to these letters that would have involved the mother and the president, right?
Yes. It was, you know, for legal reasons, Nan Britton was still alive, so I had to, you know, disguise her true identity.
Well, it was, yeah, and as I recall, she was a lover of Christian poetry, which made it even more
ironic. Yes, by this time she was a senior citizen, and she was obsessed with her poetry class down at the Senior Friendship Center.
Anyway, you have to read this book. But anyway, so back to Carrie Phillips for a second. You're less interested in her. She's not the model of things. But the other wrinkle with her was that this is all kind of taking place during the run-up to and into World War I. And so there were questions also about her as a German sympathizer, maybe trying to mold Harding's attitudes a little bit, or that maybe even she was a German spy. Can you comment on that?
Well, this has long been the rumor. I certainly don't believe that she was a German spy, because as the New York Times pointed out, there's absolutely no reference to her in any of the German intelligence archives. But she was relentless in pushing Harding toward a better attitude toward Germany. And he was smart enough not to fall for this. You know, he warned her that this was not a good idea and that she should really keep her views to herself. And it was actually one of the things that broke them up.
Well, then one now has to ask, with these two long-running affairs with Nan Britton and Carrie Phillips, what was Mrs. Harding, what was Florence Harding, Warren G. Harding's wife, all about? Is it thought that she knew about the existence of one or more of these women? And what kind of relationship, what kind of marriage did the Hardings have?
Well, they had a very interesting marriage. I always think of her as the Barbara Bush character. Her name was Florence. She was 5 years older than her husband. She was more ambitious than he was. A fortune teller told her that she had an enormous destiny, which she interpreted as meaning that her husband was going to become president. And she sort of maneuvered this. She was more politically ambitious than he was. Now, as to whether she knew about the mistresses, I mean, that's always the question. You know, does the wife know? I don't have the answer. That. I assume in a way she did.
So I know that you sort of contrast Harding a little bit to Bill Clinton, that if one thinks the worst of Bill Clinton, one thinks not only did he have, you know, more or less exploitive relationships with women like Jennifer Flowers, but that he occasionally presented himself where he wasn't wanted, and that there may have been one or more occasions where he really was sort of sexually harassing someone like Paula Corbin Jones. That's if you believe the worst about Bill Clinton. Harding seems to have not been that guy, right? I mean, just back to your original point, Robert Plunkett, there's a courtliness to all of these exchanges.
Yeah, everybody should have a boyfriend like Harding. He was terrific. He devoted a tremendous amount of time to the relationship. He would write 40-page letters while sitting in the Senate chambers listening to boring speeches. He gave you money, gave you presents. He delighted in the sexual aspects of the relationship, and he was, to a certain degree, a mentor to these women. And, you know, is that an exploitative situation? You know, that's open to interpretation. But he was not a predator. He really enjoyed this, and the women he had affairs with, from all reports, seem to have enjoyed it, too.
Well, you can't ask for more than that. All right. Bob Plunkett, thank you so much for joining us, the author of My Search for Warren G. Harding and Love Junkie. Get this. I don't know how in stock this book is, but if you can get it and read it on the beach, and you will be caught laughing and snorting sand up your nose. Please stay with us for the rest of the week. We do have an interesting show about Germany tomorrow. We'll be talking about competitive eating and prodigies later in the week. So be with us all week. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan and Kion Wolf for getting this show together.
Dear Barack, I'm Kyone Wolfe, and every night when I go to bed, I think about the two of us nuzzling under my favorite tree. You would kiss my neck, and I would tell you that I love you.
I love you back.
Wow, the NSA really does spy on my email.